Welcome to Apparently, the podcast for absolutely average parents. I'm Ann Johnsos.
And I'm Tracy Weiner. Ann and I have been friends for a very long time.
We met right after college.
Yeah, and our first jobs as radio producers.
We spent our 20s as wing women for each other, and it didn't work out very well.
But then it did, and we found the right guys and stood up in each other's weddings.
And then we had babies within weeks of each other. So we went from producers to reproducers.
Which brings us to this podcast. We want to talk about topics that interest us and you and provide some knowledge to other average parents.
We're average, not experts. So we'll tackle these topics with people who know what they're doing.
Yeah, we'll get the experts. And I fully expect to embarrass myself along the way.
I'm pretty sure we already have.
So, welcome to Apparently. We make it look easy. We make it look good. When everybody sees it, they stop and take a look. Apparently, I think parents need to be hit on the head more than a million times before a message sinks in.
Okay, I can't wait to hear where this is going.
We've all heard buzzwords like resiliency, failure, you know, the gift of failure, growth mindset, all those things. We've talked about them many times in the past. Mm-hmm. We've all read those Huffington Post articles or whatever, blogs, academic papers and news articles when it comes to parenting and family dynamics.
Yep, we've talked about helicopter parents who like swoop in and rescue their kids, and bulldozer or snowplow parents who sweep conflict out of the way so the kids never have to struggle. We've told the story about that HR person who took a call from a parent asking why her daughter didn't get the job.
Yeah.
So I'm with you. Like, how did we get here? Why are we not learning? How can we make sure our kids grow up to be successful and independent?
And not risk averse?
Exactly, not risk averse.
Remember Jessica Leahy, The Gift of Failure?
Yes.
That was one of my favorite episodes back in season one. At that time of my life, I needed that episode as my daughter was going off to middle school. I did a little course correction in my house. And like most things, I saw progress, but I know that I could do better. And like we always talk about between the two of us, you know, we try and things are hot and heavy for like a couple days or weeks.
Right.
And then we fall off the wagon. So I think we just need to be hit over the head and just hammer home some of these things that we all like acknowledge. Mm-hmm. But putting into practice is a different story.
Well, and I loved the Gift of Failure episode, too, partly because I liked watching your head explode. Because you were just like, but I have to bring him lunch. He won't be able to learn. And I was like,
he forgot his iPad. I have to bring it to him.
And I didn't need that as much as you, partly because I was a work out of the home mom for a long time. So I didn't have the option of like running something over to the school.
Yeah.
And partly because I'm lazy.
And I did. Yeah. I did. I was home and I did bring it.
Yes. But we're learning to let them take steps without us, you know, like for sure. And you can sometimes you can see them walking right into a problem. And you have to be quiet. Like, I think we're learning
sit
that.
On your hands?
Yes.
It's so painfully hard.
I know, because you want to keep them.
It's so hard.
Yes.
The struggle. It's real. It's like every day, especially with our middle schoolers. It's so painful.
Also, because you know that they're learning the lessons that we already learned, but they have to learn. We can't
I know,
tell
but
them.
I could, like, it could be learned so much faster
if we just download our memories into their brains. All right, well, so let's talk about raising successful kids who are independent and resilient to what life throws at them. We bring in Adam Russo.
He's the author of Unwritten Rules and founder of Edgewood Clinical Services. Thanks for joining us today, Adam.
No, thanks for having me.
So you can tell from our voices that like one of us is a little bit more comfortable with this topic than the other. One of the things, I just want to get right to it because I have so many questions, but in an effort to raise successful kids, one of the things that you've written about is talking about delaying gratification. And as a parent of two kids, a 13-year-old and an 11-year-old, in this day and age, right now, society thrives on instant gratification. So how can we delay gratification in our households or help them to understand that, hey, You can wait for that X, Y, or Z or whatever it is. You don't need it right now.
And we should point out too, like whether it's responding to a text, or whether it is Googling something when you don't know the answer, or whether it is watching things on demand, they don't even have to wait through commercials. So how can we teach them patience and delayed gratification?
Yeah, so you bring up some good points. So the first thing is, like, you know, when what you're talking about is how our culture's evolved over the past 15, 20 years. Because, you know, when you think about when we were growing up in the age of no internet, no cell phones, the culture, the day-to-day life, had delayed gratification embedded in it.
Sure.
If you ordered something to your house 15 years ago, it would take like 4 to 6 weeks.
Yes.
Delayed gratification. Right now, we get mad if it doesn't show up in like 2 days, right?
Or same day.
Yeah, exactly. Same day. I mean, but our culture has made that shift, right? And then as parents, we sit there and we say, like you asked the question, well, how do we teach our kids delayed gratification? Well, you know what? And if we're going to do it as parents, we have to be purposeful about it, which is going to mean we're going to actually have to be difficult people to our kids. We're going to have to purposefully make their lives a little bit harder so that they can learn how to be patient, because we can't lean on culture to do it for us, whereas we used to be able to do that. So parenting is evolving, but parents don't want to evolve, because parents want to, you know, be like their kids' champion and help them succeed and, you know, thrive and all these things. But they don't. But they look at those words as only being doing positive things. They don't, you know, meaning like happiness and, you know, pride and, you know, success and whatever they're doing. And obviously those things are great, but we also help our kids thrive by being challenging, by making things difficult, by pushing them to get comfortable in areas that they're not necessarily comfortable in. And parents don't like taking on that role, because I think parents feel guilty or uncomfortable themselves.
Yeah, we're impatient. Like, I've talked about this with Anne a million times. Like, on the news, you see the story about this, like, 3-year-old prodigy who can just sit down at the piano and just start playing, and you're like, oh my God, he's magical. You don't really ever see stories about the kid that, like, literally practice piano every day forever and ever. So it's hard, because that's not what our culture really relishes or champions or celebrates.
Yep.
And so that also, in a daily experience in your family, like, if you're not, like, hitting a grand slam the first time you're at bat, then
well, and then I find I have kids who, if they aren't great at it right away, they quit or want to. And I have the example of Sophie. When she was in fourth grade, she took clarinet and she didn't make first chair. And I said, well, maybe you could practice. And she was like,
how dare you?
Well, she was like, I prefer to be naturally good at things.
How do you combat that, Adam?
Well, that's the other thing, you know, but that's where it goes to as parents. I think it's understanding that, you know, we, like you're saying, like, we value talent. Like, it's always these people who are just inherently, they just show up with greatness. But even talent can be outworked. And so as parents, it's understanding that even if our kids are talented, they can still get outworked. So whether the talent is there or not, what's going to help kids be able to persevere going forward is understanding the value of being relentless in what they do. But if we're continuing as parents to reward the instant gratification thing, or make things easy and get problems out of their way, make sure they never feel anxious or stressed, there's nothing to work for, because it's all getting handed to them. What's the incentive to work if all you ever feel is great all the time? So as part of hard work is being challenged. It's about going through negative things and negative emotions. I'm reading a great book now called Moonshots, about how great ideas come to be. And the point that the author is making is that these societally changing inventions or discoveries have a minimum of 3 deaths before they appear. So these ideas basically die 3 separate times or more before they come to life. And these people stick with it through the deaths of these ideas. So what we think, and we look and we say, oh my gosh, here's a perfect, look at this YouTube star, they're 12 years old and they're doing all this stuff or whatever. That's not real. What's real is the perseverance getting through all the failures, but no one talks about that. But every parent I talk to, because I've spoken to thousands of them now, all of them know that's true. Because when I talk to parents, every parent looks around and says, yeah, like, life kind of sucks sometimes and we have to work through it. And they say, they look at themselves that way, they look at their friends that way, but then they look at their kids and they say, I actually want to make your life different than that. But the reality is, that's not life. life is what we've already lived, and it's going to come for them too. So we've got to best prepare them.
It's so hard.
Yeah. Well, you suggest limiting social media, and you know, I'm wondering how that builds the happy, successful kid. Is it because kids don't, you know, you talk about the YouTube, right? You know, the influencers. Is it because kids don't understand that what they see on social media isn't the truth? You know, that it's cultivated or curated?
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, it's idealized images. I mean, first of all, like every study out there, and says to some extent, I mean, whether it's a third, a half, or whatever the case is, that people of the people who are heavy on social media usage have a higher, you know, the likelihoods of depression increase dramatically. So, and that's true for adults also. So it's heavy social media use is what it does is it shows everybody typically in their best light at that moment of time, and so when people get heavy into social media, what starts to seep in is this idea that all these people's lives going so well, and they look at, and then they introspectively look at their own and say, mine isn't that good. And what's hard for kids is that they cannot filter out that that these are just snapshots in time for people, and so their depression and the FOMO, so to speak, fear of missing out, kicks in too, because they look at what other people are doing that they're not doing or how happy people are, and then they start questioning themselves, and that puts them into a spiral, and it really attacks their self-confidence.
So should they have any access to social media, or do you have specific?
No, yeah, I think that they should, and I think especially more, I think, high school age than anything else. But at this, because on the flip side, there's a reality, right? The reality is technology is a part of our culture. Period. That's not going away. The important part, though, is for kids to understand how to use technology for their own benefit. The phone is for them; they don't work for the phone, right? Like there's a difference, and which is why, like I would say, for parents, just on a simple level, like you talked about instant gratification and texting and things like that. To me, a number one starting point is that kids with a phone should not have any kind of notifications on for texting or for like social, like any kind of social things or whatever the case is, because they get trained like Pavlov. You know, this thing goes off, they have to run to it. And when notifications are off or it's on a do not disturb mode for a vast majority of things, they're able to have control over their own usage. And that's the first thing that kids need to learn. Otherwise, they just get pulled into the vortex of apps and YouTube and whatever else, and they never get out. So they have to be able to use the phone for their own benefit, not the other way around.
That's a good point, and maybe I go turn off her notifications.
Yeah, the push notifications, exactly, because they ding.
I'm a sucker for it too.
Yeah,
me too. I'm guilty over here because I have them, and I automatically go, I better go check. Nothing's that urgent, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly, and that's what I'm saying. It's little things, and it's why I wrote my book, because parents like to think that there's going to be some kind of watershed moment that their kids are just going to get it. Their kids are going to understand what perseverance is, and they're going to understand how to work through a problem or be challenged. And the reality is, like, there's no moment in time. But I wrote my book because what I want to highlight it's how parents respond to the little things every day with the same messaging and the same strategy over and over and over again that will then give kids the tools to be able to succeed once they graduate high school. Because to me, as a parent, what parents are getting caught in today is a choice, and parents have a hard time with this choice. They're parenting on one of two tracks. They're parenting either to raise kids to look as good as they can on paper when they graduate high school, or they're raising kids to be adaptive and independent adults post-graduation of high school. And the reality is you have to pick one side, but parents are terrified of their kids not looking as good on paper. Therefore, they're not giving the kids the opportunity to learn the skills to be successful post-high school.
Exactly. You mentioned independence and like trying to encourage independence. And one of the things that I was reading from your book was the example of like if your kid wants a video game or playing basketball and wants to be like the star on the basketball team, and how you handle those situations can encourage independence. Like if I'll be honest, my son's come and said, hey, I want this Wii game or I want this. And I'm just like, okay, let's go buy it. When there's actually a learning opportunity to be like, okay, not only can I delay his gratification, but he can like figure out for himself how to raise the money or earn the money to go ahead and buy it for himself and be independent. Is that basically the essence?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, we have, just because we have means to do things doesn't mean that we should, you know. And I think that it was easier, you know, however many years ago when it was maybe a little bit economically more difficult for people to buy things. So the answer was just always no. But now that, I mean, economically speaking, you know, there's more and more people that that are doing well financially. And so what happens is they find themselves wanting to continue to give their kids maybe things that they never had the opportunity to have or whatever the case is. But we have that. But that's the example of on a small scale. If the importance is delaying gratification, how do we use that theme every time? Right? A kid might want to go for ice cream. Okay. Well, can you empty the dishwasher and clean the kitchen before we go? Right? Like, it's these little things that build in. Like, you've got to work hard for things. The good things don't just naturally appear because you asked for them. And that's just one example of strategy and communication.
When you gave the basketball example, I'll be honest with you. Your example was when a kid goes out and shoots hoops and wants to be like the star basketball player. And then after a couple of minutes, they're like, I suck. And yeah. They come inside and whatever. And you mentioned, and this is something I'm probably not that great at, but to empathize with them and say, I see that you're upset about the struggle, but what do you think you should do? Do you think you should go back out there? And yeah, but you might not make a couple baskets now, but I bet if you keep doing it a couple more times, I bet you're going to sink some more three-pointers or whatever, like that type of situation. So not just like saying, oh, stop, don't get upset about, like, because I have done that.
Yeah, don't get upset. Yeah.
Don't be upset about that.
Yeah, because we do get upset. I mean, the reality is, like, we do get frustrated when things don't go the way we want them to, right? So the emotion that kids have is a valid one, right? We it's frustrating, you know, and you want to quit sometimes, and that's true for adults. But what we want to do is get them comfortable with the process of it. We want them to get comfortable with the process. If they tried something, it's failing, it's not going well, here's all the things that you're feeling. But just because you feel all these things, those feelings and emotions doesn't create a finality. It's just how you feel about this one thing. And just because you feel these things, you are capable of working through the emotion to continue to work and eventually get to where you want to go. So while I use that example for basketball, there was a study that was done that talked about whether or not, you know, if people have a major professional catastrophe happen in their life, adults, meaning that if they get fired, they get laid off, things like that, that if that's a career-ending thing for them, like they won't be able to move up any further in their careers and in other organizations. And what research said is that it's just not true, that people who have a major professional catastrophe are capable of continuing to move up in other organizations, but the perception of the catastrophe is what derails people. That if people view those catastrophes as simply a failure, that they're seven times less likely to continue to move on than people who view those catastrophes as just a learning opportunity, just something that, you know, a bump in the road.
A hiccup.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's why, like, that basketball example is one. It's just an everyday example that a lot of kids kind of go through. And there's tons of those little things. And that's why, as parents, we have to encourage them through the emotional overwhelming piece of the process, because we know that when they're an adult, they're going to have that same type of hardship in an adult situation. And we want them to be emotionally and mentally strong enough to be able to move through it, not get swallowed up by it.
So you talk about teaching resiliency. Is that an example then? You know, like, walking them through their emotions, validating their emotions, and then telling them that go back out there because you will eventually get to the other side of it?
Absolutely. And, you know, and people, you know, think that, you know, I think the hard part with kids, too, is that they believe that emotions are real. I mean, emotions are not, I mean, they feel real, but they're not accurate. They're not accurate by any stretch. You know, I mean, most people are scared when they do something new. After somebody does that new thing, how many people would say that their anxieties of the negative outcome were ultimately justified? I would say it's a small number, because we get anxious about everything. But, I mean, could you imagine how many people wouldn't do things just out of fear? You know, we'd still be living in the Stone Ages. You know what I mean? Someone had to get in the first airplane, right? I mean, it's like, so there's always fear, but it doesn't mean just because we're scared, it means that doesn't mean things are never going to work. And that's how we have to help our kids think. Just because you're feeling things, and it might even be overwhelming, you can't let that emotion guide you. But we're so driven by empathy in our culture that it's really hard to separate that out for kids.
I agree with the emotional conflict that you speak of, because, you know, it's like the
the standard, the gold standard in parenting is that you want your kid to be happy. And like, it's always like, you can't be sad, or, oh, I'm going to fix it so that you're not sad anymore. And frankly, as adults, we all, there's days that really suck, and, mm-hmm. and you're sad or you're disappointed and whatever. So we're, by taking those situations away from our kids, we're not like setting them up for success later, because we're not letting them deal at an early age that, you know what, sometimes life just really does suck.
Yeah. Well, and the other piece of this is, most adults would say that emotional intelligence, having emotional intelligence, is essential for personal and professional success in adulthood, right? And the thing of it is, as parents, though, we look at our kids and we say, well, we want you to experientially feel happiness and excitement, but we want you to theoretically understand guilt, shame, embarrassment, disappointment, anxiety. We don't really want you to feel those things, but we want you to kind of understand that they exist.
Yeah, like, and then you should read about those things, right?
Yeah,
you should
exactly.
read about those.
And,
look at that over there, but don't actually feel that way. Just look
exactly.
at it.
Exactly. We don't want you to feel it. You know, so, but then they get old. Then they get older, and then we wonder why young people can't cope with negative feelings, because we're not teaching it. We're spending too much time making sure they don't feel it, but yet we'll also say emotional intelligence is really important. Well, we got to pick one. As parents, if we value emotional intelligence, well, we got to teach them all the emotions. We can't just teach them the good emotions, you know. So we have to make these choices as parents. But as parents, you know, when we go down those, when we really look at both sides of the coin and say we're going to parent honestly, it's going to make us feel uncomfortable as parents. But that's our problem, and we've got to be able to overcome that as parents.
You talk about the importance of consistency. Anne and I joke about this all the time. The only thing that's consistent in our households is the inconsistency.
So, but wait, that does make us consistent, though.
We're consistently saying that.
Yeah.
So life gets in your way and stuff. So how can you make things consistent? How can we make that work in our house?
Well, I think there's a very big difference between things kind of in a practical sense being consistent versus a strategic sense being consistent. And I think that's where people get lost. I think it's really hard to be consistent practically in a household, especially with multiple kids. I mean, there's just too many variables that are constantly happening to ensure a high level of consistency. When I'm saying a high level of consistency, something over 70% of the time. I mean, it's really difficult. But strategically speaking, it's very, I think, a lot easier to be consistent, because if parents are aligned in the strategy of what they want to teach their kids, there's always an opportunity to impart that message, even if what's happening practically is just changing constantly. And that's why I think it's more important as a parent to have a strategy about what you're trying to do and not worry about the tactics, how you're going to do it. Because that's going to vary from family to family. But the strategy, I think, is what's most important. And I think that's where I think most parents get caught, because I think they think, I just want to make things easy for my kids today. That's not a long-term strategy. And that's where I go back to, as a parent, if you have a kid who's 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, I mean, the question is, Are you trying to make it so that their high school, junior high life is going to be easy and smooth, or are you preparing them for the day they graduate 10 years out? And those are completely different strategies, but you got to pick one, because if you're preparing for them just to be, you know, do well or be happy that day, then you're certainly not preparing them for later. And so then if that's the case, you got to be prepared for the fallout of that.
Yeah, it's a marathon, not a sprint.
Exactly.
But what, you know, when you talk about strategy, do you have like suggested examples of things to do? You know, so whether it is you can't go to the slumber party, or I'm just trying to think of like how I could implement a long-term strategy to help my kids have more emotional range.
So here's the thing, right? So the slumber party, like you just said, the slumber party example, I wouldn't use that as a parent, only because I think that there's a lot of things that depend. I mean, if you have a kid who maybe is struggling socially and they, you know, and this is a good opportunity for them, you're going to want them to go, right? So I think you've got to look at it from kid to kid. What I would say on a long-term strategy, like an example I would use is, a lot of schools, especially starting in elementary school, kids are getting like Chromebooks and whatever in the schools to use. And so what inevitably seems to happen, and I talked to a lot of parents about this, and you know, what inevitably happens is it's bedtime, right? Kids are elementary age, they're getting ready for bed. They might even be in bed. And what happened? They have to charge their Chromebook. Where's the Chromebook? Downstairs. Where's
that happened last night.
There you go. Where's the charger? In their room. The question is, who goes to get the Chromebook?
The kid.
That's the, well, they should, right?
Yeah.
But how many parents, to make the things easier, go smoother,
and quicker,
a fight or a conflict, yep, just go down and
go
get
to bed.
It.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about as far as strategy goes. How, you know, it's these little things every day that impart ownership and accountability. And you can certainly hold kids accountable, like on a big event kind of a thing, but that's not a long-term strategy. It's one event that you're going to use as kind of a point to make a point. I'm talking about the little things every day. You know, if kids are, most houses have a kitchen, right? And then there's a family room right off of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, usually a parent is in the kitchen kind of doing whatever they're doing. And a kid is oftentimes watching TV or whatever they're doing in the family room. And how many times does a kid say, regardless of how old they are, hey, I'm thirsty. Can you get me something to drink?
Oh my God, that happens in my house all the time.
And if a parent is by the sink, maybe the cup's right there, like, oh yeah, you know, here you go, right? But again, the question is, at what point do you say, you know, I'm doing this, you can go get it yourself.
I just want to take some credit here because I'm like, the water comes out of a faucet in the fridge and the cups are next to the fridge. Get a cup.
I know, yeah. But that first time when I pushed back, like when they were little, I would do it. But then as I got older, I was like, you have two legs. Get up.
Yeah.
And they looked at me like with this horror, like, what? You don't love me. You're not bringing me water. I was like, for real?
Yeah.
Go get up off your butt and go get your own water.
But that's an example, Adam, of like teaching them to do things for themselves, right?
Well, that's what I'm saying. And it's a small example. But if you think about the number of times over the course of a day, there's opportunities for that.
Mm-hmm.
That teaches them reliability, accountability, right? And it's a little thing. And because what we tend to do as parents is focus on these big events. But the big events are important, but the kids learn how to manage the bigger events by appropriately starting to manage the small ones. And if we're not giving our kids a chance to be held accountable for the small ones, then how are they possibly going to be, do well or thrive when the big things come around?
Yeah. All right. So I like the way you talk about how kids can handle their worries. Whether it's a test or an activity, you say to break it down into best case and the worst case and the most likely scenarios. So mm-hmm. What does that do for the kid when they have to think it through that way?
Well, because what it does, you know, we tend to, our worries tend to just kind of go out of control. I mean, it's for adults too. I mean, we can foresee 1,000 different things happening that are all terrible, right? When we think about things that we worry about, what we're trying to do when I say that to kids, it's really about teaching them how to reality test. Because the thing of it is, maybe they should be worried about something, but there's a reality and a range of worry that's most likely, and mm-hmm. and that's what we're trying to get them to do, right? If they don't do well on a test, they might be terrified they're not going to like get into Harvard, right? Because of this one test. I mean, the reality is that's just
not
if
likely.
They're destined to go there. It's that this one test isn't the case, right? You know, so let's really go to, and have they ever really failed a test? Well, no, they've never really failed a test. Okay, so then let's not even worry about failing a test, right? Like, let's just try to break it down. The reality is, typically where it falls is that, like, about a test, the odds are, especially if a kid has never really failed and they tend to do, you know, fairly well, what, they're going to get a C or a D? Okay, that's really the real worst case scenario. Then, you know, and then it goes to, okay, so if that's the case, then what would I do? And then they can kind of think from there. But if they're making it a catastrophic future problem, that's just, it's overblown. And now they're going to really get themselves all tied up about something that isn't even relevant. So what we want to try to do is, if you're going to worry, fine, but worry about the right things.
Right. That happens in my house when the kids are like, Mom, everybody's got blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, so who's everybody? And then they're like, Jimmy and Johnny. I'm like, is that everybody? And then I totally bust them on it because they're prone to hyperbole. Like, everything is so epically large, mm-hmm. and really, it's like, okay, is it really everybody? Or is it two people that you really like that are your friends and you want to do something with them?
Right.
That happens all the time.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And that's all we're trying to do, is just because, again, it's training them to think about their worry and to put it and to think about it in terms that are going to help them going forward. It's not don't worry about it, because we do worry. But if we're going to worry, let's worry about it accurately, not in some exaggerated form where 98% of our worries aren't even possibly coming true. Let's worry about the 2% that can.
Yeah. So I've also noticed that anxiety or fear of failure can paralyze my kids. Like, you know, if they think they have to be perfect, they'd rather not try than try and fail. Yeah. So someone said at one point, like, if you're not failing, you're not learning. Is that, like, let's say I have a kid, like, I have one now who doesn't think she's good at soccer. And she's fine at soccer, you know, for an 11-year-old. And so she's like, I don't want to play anymore. What do you counsel in terms of the kid who doesn't want to do something just because she thinks she's not going to be good?
Well, it goes to, this is where, again, it goes to the strategy of it, right? I mean, we are such an outcomes-based culture at this point. You can say with instant gratification, you know, we look at college admission as a validation of our parenting and our kids' opportunity for success into the future. Test scores. We look at all these objective outcomes as basically a zero-sum game. Either you have them or you don't. And everything seems to be geared toward that. And kids get that messaging. And I think as parents, it goes more along the lines of, do we really think that way, or do we think about our kids' life and them growing up as more of a continuum? That it's just an ongoing process with good and bad outcomes along the way. And so, as parents, if our kids are talking in those terms about not wanting to try because they're not good at it or whatever the case is, it's our job as parents to reinforce the value of the process. It's not about whether or not they try to eventually work hard to convince them that they can be good, because that's outcomes based, and ultimately it might not even be true. But we want them to get comfortable in the process of working hard and knowing that at the end of that road there could be good or not so good outcomes, because that mirrors life. Because we don't know what we work hard at if we're ultimately how successful we're going to be or not at all. So that's the mindset that we want them to get trained in, and that's the roller coaster that they're eventually going to get on once they graduate college.
Just try.
Get there on the field and kick that ball.
Exactly. Just try hard. And you know what? You're going to have good games. You're going to have bad games.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it is. But again, that mirrors life. And so that's why I talk about it strategically. If you're a parent who's focused more on, you know, your kid getting on the, you know, highest level travel soccer team, well, that's outcomes based. Then your goals are totally different. Then you don't really care about what your kid is going through as long as they achieve an outcome. And then when kids get to that point, then they are incredibly sensitive to outcomes, because then, you know, if that's the thought and strategy of how they're being taught across the board, then all they're going to focus on is good outcomes. And then the second a bad outcome comes along, they're not prepared to handle it. But again, as adults, we all know that bad outcomes come along. So how are we preparing our kids to manage the inevitable? And I think that's the hard part for parents, is that we don't want to believe that these negative things are inevitable.
And I'm thinking, too, back to my childhood, I was very outcomes focused. And sometimes it led me to, like, circumvent the process, you know, where if I could get something done well without doing all the work, you know, I like not cheating, but like, you know, mm-hmm. I would write a paper on the first chapter of a book rather than read the whole book. Right. You know, so if you only focus on outcomes, you're teaching them not to do the work.
Exactly. Yep, exactly. And that's the whole point, right? Because when you do that, how does that translate into adulthood? It just doesn't. I mean, you know, and so that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, what is ultimately the goal of when we're raising kids, what we're trying to get them to do? And if we just focus on how do we make things easy for them so that they can get the best outcomes the fastest, it's why millennials at this point stay on a job, 9 months on average?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're waiting for the next great thing. And when it doesn't come, they just try to look for something else. That's how those mindsets at young ages translate into older. That people have a hard time persevering because it's not going quickly, and then they get frustrated. I didn't get promoted that first time. I have to go to another company. Well, nothing changed. You know, you're still the same person who's not going to get promoted at the next place. But people are externalizing and thinking it's the place's fault, not their own.
Right.
And that's why accountability is so important, because people have to, you know, kids have to learn how to look in a mirror and assess themselves.
Well, what does that mean for the future, though? Because if the millennials are acting like that, feel like that now, our kids who, with parents like me, if they're setting themselves up for, it's going to even look even worse later.
Well, but I think it's short term, because I think, you know, again, I mean, we're kind of in this weird cultural transition of, you know, you have a lot of parents who grew up without technology raising kids with it. So you have parents who have no idea how to handle social media, raising kids who have no idea how to handle social media, right? And a number of times I hear parents plead ignorance about, I can't manage my kids' technology use because I don't know what to do. I don't know anything about it. Learn. You have to learn. You know, it's the accountability is the same thing. Just because you don't know doesn't mean it's an excuse for your kid to do whatever they want. So, we're in this cultural transition. And I think eventually when you have, kids today who grew up with phones from day one and the internet from day one, that when they have their families, they'll understand the impact a heck of a lot more than we do. And so those things will start to shift, I think, back in another 20 years or so. But right now, it's a real issue of that. But at the same time, it's the accountability of how, we are also a society that caters to every need of every individual, to the point where individuals, if they don't get what they want, they feel justified in blaming everybody else. And we do not push culturally an overall accountability. And that's why I think at home, if we can start doing that with kids, that'll shift as well.
That's a great idea. And it's so scary to think about the society that blames everyone else and doesn't take responsibility for our own actions.
Yeah, it goes back to, I'll say infamous. I don't know, infamous. I always remember it. The woman who sued McDonald's because the coffee was too hot and the lid fell. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, it's that kind of stuff that permeates, why would you do that? You know, and there was even a Seinfeld episode on that where, I don't know if you watch Seinfeld,
yes,
so Kramer put the coffee in his pants and it spilled all over him and he sued the coffee place.
Yes.
The lid wasn't on tight, right? Like, at what point do you own your own choices, period? And as parents, we feed that for better or worse. So I think that's where the responsibility falls on us.
I feel like having these conversations with your spouse, all these strategies and accountability and consistency, it's so hard in the day-to-day. It's like I equated to my husband when he's in meetings all day long. I'm like, when do you actually get your job done and do the things that you're talking about in these meetings? That's kind of like life in a family and a household. Like, there's so many chores and things and places you got to be. Like, there's like, when can you stop time and be like, okay, let's talk about how we're going to handle X, Y, or Z that's happening in our family. It's very hard.
Yeah.
It's hard to have a long view when you're right in the middle of it.
Well, and that's the thing.
We're like swimming, treading water.
Yeah, but you've got to have a long view. And swimming is actually a pretty good example to use. My oldest daughter swims, and it's so interesting because the swimmer mindset is, you work crazy hard for months, and you're in the pool however long, but this whole thing is geared toward just maybe a couple of meets, because you want to work as hard as you can to get geared up for the meets at the end of the year where you're going to explode out of the water. But no one's expecting good outcomes, you're hoping for good outcomes, but your best outcomes are coming when you're fully trained. And it's the same type of narrative, right? You're not going to jump in the pool and swim and have your best time on your second practice. You're going to do it after, tons of hours and after tons of weeks in the water. And it's the same metaphor for raising our kids. They're going to do best with all that practice through their first 18 years. So by the time they graduate college, they're set up to then go.
Thank you so much, Adam Russo, author of Unwritten Rules and founder of Edgewood Clinical Services. This was all really great information. As I said at the beginning, like, we all have to, as parents, have to be hit over the head like a gazillion times for it to sink in, and how to navigate our households and raise these strong, independent, resilient kids that we want to have at the end of the journey here, right, before we push them out the door.
Right.
So thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Thanks, Adam.
So, apparently, we need to back up and let our kids feel the pain, the frustration, the negativity, be sad, be frustrated, to drive them to be stronger and more successful people as adults.
And we have to let them be mad at us, which is the hardest part.
That's going to suck.
I can't stand that. So
that's going
to
be rough.
It's hard to sit on your hands and let them struggle. It's hard to not want to save them. But we've got to support them and guide them on their journey. Otherwise, they're going to go away and not be ready. And then they're going to live in our basements. Which is okay with me.
Not if I am accountable and consistent.
Exactly. So, a side note, last week Hannah said to me, when we go to college, are you and Daddy going to move and get out of the house? And I was like, well, I don't know, maybe. And she said, I don't know, I don't think you should. And I said, why not? She said, I'm not sure if med school is going to work out.
Like, you're 11.
God bless her.
Yeah.
Well, we'd love to prove how resilient we are. And
yes. Oh my God.
See how I tied that in?
Yeah,
I'm trying really hard.
Yeah.
Please go and rate on iTunes. Rate, apparently, wherever you get it. Please leave a review for us. Share our podcast with your friends. If there's a particular episode that you really liked, share that. Text it to your friends. Say, hey, check out this episode of about whatever the topic is with your friends.
Sure. And we just want your feedback. And if you have suggestions for topics, check out our Facebook page, share our posts. We put some funny stuff up there. It's not all serious. Give us a call at 331-704-0046.
Or you can email us at apparentlypodcast@gmail.com. This is a WGN Plus podcast. I'm Tracy Weiner.
And I'm Ann Johnsos. Thanks for listening to Apparently. We make it look easy. Look good.